This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Callie Crossley. We're talking about today's literature. Will it be relevant in 2080? It's a premise that the folks at Smithsonian Magazine brought up, and we're extending this question to the radio. On today's New York Times bestseller list, Cold Days by Jim Butcher tops the fiction hardcover list, and The Life of Pi is number one for fiction paperbacks. Can you see these two books being relevant 60, 80, 100 years from now? Joining us to take this on are Thomas Connolly, a professor of English at Suffolk University, and Sue Weaver Schopp, associate dean for the Master of Liberal Arts program at the Harvard Extension School. Welcome back, you two.
Well, hello.
Thank you.
So this started with a literary magazine called The Colophon in 1936, when those editors said, let's predict 10 authors that'll still be relevant in 2000, the year 2000. And this is why we're looking at it now, projecting forward to 2080. Now, on their list at that time, they came up with Eugene O'Neill, Willa Cather, Robert Frost, and a few others. And Sinclair Lewis was the top. Those all seem, you know, those are all names we know now, right, Tom?
Yes. I don't know how many people read Sinclair Lewis anymore, but that's a name that I think most people still recognize. What struck me about this was these are not generically identical authors. You've got a poet, playwright, James Truslow Adams, who was a popular historian. It made me think of David McCullough, who's around today. But it also made me think about this whole, the idea of a poll and the idea of what this magazine was in 1936. In the middle of the Depression, it was a very elegant magazine with high production values. But in the middle of the Depression, their readership dipped, and they tried to go more popular. And doing something like this was their idea on how to attract more readers. I mean, this is a time when Hollywood movies were featuring opera stars, when concert pianists would play boogie-woogie. There was much more of cross-fertilization between so-called highbrow, lowbrow, and middlebrow art. And, you know, we were just talking in the green room beforehand that this is just gone from today. I mean, we were hard-pressed asking.
Well, what's gone? Cross-fertilization or culture in general?
Cross-fertilization. Okay. The idea, you know, we couldn't come up with 10 writers like this. I mean, I don't want to speak for you. But it's fascinating to me that today, this conversation absolutely cannot take place the same way it did in 1936.
Sue Weaver Schopp, what do you think? So you both agreed that you couldn't come up with 10 writers that the way that these editors did back in 1936, and that's because of the cross-fertilization, or because there is a lack thereof, as far as you're concerned.
Well, it seems to me there's several things that have changed radically. One is that we are in an age of globalization, where the literary canon is so much larger than it used to be. And when I say the canon, I don't mean works that have necessarily been canonized. I mean just the proliferation of works that are coming at us from so many different cultures. Many writers we haven't even heard of before, particularly writers who've won the Nobel Prize recently. I've actually never spoken with a single colleague who has read any of the recent Nobel Prize winning
writers. I was thinking of the Iranian writer. Was it the Pulitzer or the Nobel Prize winner? The Iranian writer who won and was fairly well known, whose name I can't remember right at the moment. But is this what you're talking about, though?
About, that a number of the writers who win things like the National Book Award Prize or that win the Pulitzer Prize or the Nobel Prize, they're not necessarily writers that we're broadly familiar with. So I think the proliferation of writers coming at us from so many different countries and so forth, in the first place, makes it more difficult for us to actually keep up with all of the writers that might potentially be great writers. We just have a much wider group to choose from. I would also say another really important thing that's happened is that the world of publishing has changed tremendously. We have a variety of books coming at us now in media that we never had before. We have e-text, we have online publishing, we have audiobooks. I mean, we have a whole lot of different ways in which we can digest literature. But also, publishing itself has become a lot more commercial than it was back in the 1930s. You used to have, I think, the golden age of editors and the golden age of book publishers. Places like the publishing house of Alfred Knopf, for example, New Directions Press, run by James Laughlin, Faber and Faber in London with T.S. Eliot at its helm. And these were editors and publishers who went after the very best new talent and were not afraid to take a risk. And their publishing houses were not afraid to take a risk. And so we don't have exactly quite that same group of publishers and editors now that sort of help the reading public towards the writers that are the most innovative and likely to be the longest lasting.
That's my guest, Sue Weaver Shopp. She is Associate Dean for the Master of Liberal Arts Program at the Harvard Extension School. And Tom Connolly, Professor of English at Suffolk University, is bursting to say something. Go ahead.
Also, what's going on now is writers talk to writers. This is a list for readers.
The 1936 list.
Yes, the 1936 list from the Colophon was very much put together by a group of editors thinking about what do people read, and they read the same things that we read. But when you get together a list of book award nominees and contrast it with the bestseller list, never the twain shall meet. The other thing is, you know, things like graphic novels, screenplays being turned into novels. I mean, the sort of cross-fertilization we have now is between media. Mm. It's not between different levels of readership. And, you know, reducing this to, well, those days were elitist is really irrelevant today.
Well, I was getting ready to go there, but go ahead.
Yeah, because it's such, the market is exponentially larger. Mm-hmm. There are millions and millions of more readers reading what they want to read on the web or on their various devices. And also publishing houses, you know, there are three or four international mega publishers, but within those publishing houses are micro and even boutique lines where very small press runs can be created, and now even e-runs can be created. Now, you know, I don't want to sound like a, you know, critical Pollyanna, but in some ways, we may be on the verge of a new type of age reminiscent of the 1930s, where because readers can now literally create their own reading list, there'll be the possibility of this through self-publishing or through the proliferation of more sophisticated e-texts.
Well, when you had writers talking to writers, you know, which I have a few issues with because that's really a closed circle in so many situations, because I pulled the 10 best books of 2012 from the New York Times. And, you know, there's some predictable names on there. But I thought to myself, OK, you know, this is the same little group of guys that I'm assuming all guys get in the room and decide, you know, who what the 12 best books will be, and why would I be surprised? Not saying anything about the worth of these books. I'm just making that statement. But then I think to myself, at least in this group, people are respecting, I presume, even the writing, the talent of the writing is reflected in this list, I'm hoping. And I wonder if we readers at this point, look for that. Are we just looking for a story? There's nothing wrong with looking for a story, a good story. But is that something that is not at the top of the list to be appreciated, so that therefore if we were to be asked to put a list together like this, that would not be something that would be considered at the top, Sue Weaver Shopp?
That's a great question. I think right now we are in an age of genre fiction. And this is one of the things that I think has actually changed, certainly in the last few years. By genre fiction, I mean things like paranormal fiction, post-apocalyptic fiction, fantasy literature, mysteries. These are things that are at the top of the bestseller list in terms of what's selling in Barnes & Noble, for example, and surveys that are taken at a variety of bookstores about the things that sell most in a given year. You're not going to ever put writers like Stephanie Meyer or...
That's the Twilight author. Mm-hmm.
Or Suzanne Collins, who wrote the Hunger Games series. John Grisham, who has written wildly popular legal bestseller fiction. Stephen King, who is one of the most read novelists in the world. His canon is
in history,
yeah. Exactly.
Well, let me pause
enormous.
On Stephen King, because he can write anything. I mean,
yes,
he's written
he
about, I mean, he's such a breadth of material, you would think
exactly.
That he might be one to be on a list like this because of the variety of it that he can bring to the table. No?
I think he's one of the writers who will be read 50 years from now because readers love his work.
And they return to it.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And each new generation seems to be introduced to some of his older fiction as well as his current fiction. And he is just a fiction-making machine. He keeps turning out new things all the time. So whether the critics approve of his writing or not, or think of him as one of the great authors of the 20th and 21st century, that's a different matter. Readers definitely appreciate him. But I think there is this tremendous divide between the writers who readers will return to repeatedly because they like their work. And they like genre fiction now. They like things that take us into worlds of fantasy and so on, or that think about the anxieties of the present age in terms of what the future will look like. People are really drawn to those things, even if they don't seem to have tremendous literary merit as far as literary critics and academics are concerned. But this is a very different thing from the kinds of writers who do win the prizes and who are taught in universities. Again, this is one of the really interesting things to me about that 1936 list. Except for three people on that list, all the rest of those writers have been kept alive primarily because they're taught in university classrooms.
Well, let's pause there and let Tom, and I want you to weigh in on that, because that is important in terms of keeping names and works in front of future generations.
Yeah, just two things. One word we didn't mention was buzz. A couple of years ago, there was a novel, The Secret History by Donna Tartt, which got a lot of acclaim. It was a huge bestseller. People are still waiting for the movie, which probably isn't going to happen. But there's that sort of novel, which a first novel, something else with editors and publishers now. Novels are often rushed into print and promoted excessively. And the writers become exhausted. I mean, Donna Tartt hasn't been heard from since with anything significant. But also, this makes its way into classrooms, too. There are certain novelists that, you know, you've got to teach this novel. I mean, you've got to teach this work. And unfortunately, you know, someone like Willa Cather, who I think is one of the great American writers by any standard, My Antonia, that's the book of hers that's taught. The Age of Innocence is the book by Edith Wharton that you teach. For Eugene O'Neill, Long Day's Journey Tonight, you know, unless you're in a specialized seminar. But, you know, there's certain, it's not even just certain authors who make the list. It's certain works by that author that make the list.
Let me let people know who was on that list, because we mentioned a couple of people. So you, Sinclair Lewis, Willa Cather, Eugene O'Neill, Edna St. Vincent Millay, Robert Frost. Robert Frost, I mean, you know, come on, everybody.
Yeah.
Taking a walk in the
yes.
woods. Okay. Theodore Dresser. Let's see who else is on here. James Branch Cabal, I never heard of him. Stephen Vincent Benet and George Santayana. James Trusloff Adams, you said he was a popular historian. And then the editors added some other folks who should be named. Thomas Wolfe, H.L. Mencken, Ernest Hemingway, and Hervé Allen. To think about Ernest Hemingway not being on the original list is pretty amazing to me. But so that's the list from 1936. We've thrown out some names of people who maybe could be on a list and agree that it's difficult because of all of the reasons that you've said to try to figure out who might make a top 10 now. What about folks who are serving as erstwhile editors for the rest of us to point us in the direction? If it's not being taught, that was one way for us to learn about certain authors and works. There are other folks like Oprah Winfrey.
Yes.
Who, you know, brought folks back to what some call classic and then introduced us to more modern writers. What do you think about the selection she made and whether those would be authors that
Well, there's also the book club networks, too.
Right,
now you
right.
can buy books with, it's almost like a teacher's guide. It's the book club guide with the right questions to ask.
They usually go along the commercial lines,
I have
to say, except my book club, we're outside of that. But moving on. But I'm curious about the impact of an Oprah in terms of getting people to think outside of what they might read.
She's been amazing for bringing people back to some of the older works of literature. Suddenly they appear on the bestseller list again because of her recommendations. And I actually heard her yesterday morning on NPR with a new author who has just published her first novel. And Oprah has recommended that novel. And apparently the Amazon site crashed because after the recommendation came in, so many people wanted the book, which is great for the new author. Oprah, I think, has excellent literary taste. The novels that she chooses tend to be either well-established books that have been forgotten somehow by literary historians, or else things that she reads that have something very fresh, but also at the same time, as she was saying yesterday, something that has really universal appeal, you know, that's going to speak to a wide number of people, not just a small audience, but a work that says something very true about human nature and human experience.
Yeah, I think she does a lot better with fiction than she does with the self-help books. I was amazed, though, that her attempt to revive Dickens was a major flop.
It was? I mean, why?
She recommended Great Expectations, and unlike the case with Anna Karenina, which everybody on the train I take was reading, nobody picked up on Great Expectations for some reason.
So why do you think that is? Because that's taught. That's being taught as well.
Yes,
so there are many
yes.
reasons why that should be.
Perhaps it was the point you made about, you know, Dickens isn't a particularly forgotten writer.
No.
And with Anna Karenina, people tend to think with Russian novels, oh, it's too long. But of course, they got into it, and you know, there's the movie.
So I'm going to suggest that maybe that is one case where it's so taught that it felt like I've seen and been.
This.
I don't need this.
Yeah.
I've been there and done there. I want to mention for people who don't know the name of the book that she's recommending now. It's called The 12 Tribes of Hattie by Ayanna Mathis. And I had just gotten that book, so I'm looking forward to it as well. So before she recommended it, someone had recommended it to me. So this must be a young woman with a great amount of talent.
One of Oprah's great choices that surprised me that suddenly went back to the bestseller list was East of Eden.
Mm. Yes.
And that was, to me, that was a remarkable recommendation. But suddenly there it was on the bestseller list for a few weeks just because of her recommendation. Okay. I think that's marvelous.
And for people who only knew, you know, Of Mice and Men or maybe, you know, Grapes of Wrath. I mean, the East of Eden was a real forgotten Steinbeck.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Well, as much as there seems to be more media available to put forth books in whatever form, where, you know, not just the paper, but the e and everything else. So there's much more out there. There's some question about whether people are reading more. I'm not quite sure how to answer that. And the bottom line is, I want you two to come up with at least two books that you would say would be around for 2080 or two authors, because I'm interested to see where you would go, given that there's so many places to draw from now.
We're ready.
All right. Okay, Tom Connelly.
Into the flames.
All right. All right.
Well, I think we're both in agreement on these two, Toni Morrison and Philip Roth.
Toni Morrison's at the top of my
list. Absolutely, Toni Morrison, because A, she has a reading public all her own, clearly delineated, but she's also the most frequently taught author in the English-speaking world. So she has all bases covered.
She was just at Harvard last week, and boy, was she good. Still, you know.
Yeah, Toni Morrison is the sort of author. That, really, she's her own woman. She's on a pedestal all her own, and she. Of all, living writers, I think, is the only one who's at the level of the list we have from 1936, where everyone knows who she is, everyone has read her, and almost everyone respects her.
So let me ask this question, because it'll lead into your giving me your next selections.
Yeah.
And that is it because, and I know the two of you think about this, she is putting forth some themes that tap into where folks are, or that she's reminding us or bringing us to things we haven't. Why do you think that, you know, she, aside from her incredible writing talent, should be on that list?
Well, one of the things that people who teach literature, I think, have to come to grips with is, what do we mean by greatness in literature? Because it's a very elastic term, and it's a very subjective term in a lot of ways. So my own criteria for greatness in literature tends to boil down to two or three features. The first thing is that the writer takes us a place we've never been before. By that, I mean the writer takes us either into a psychological space that is entirely fresh and new, but that resonates with us as readers. Once you're in that territory, you can say, aha. Very interesting. I've thought about that before, but it's never come to the foreground of my thinking until this writer illuminated it for me in this way. Or it can be something that is totally novel, which really does take you someplace you've never been before and therefore introduces you to a new world. I also think about the quality of the writing. I also think about innovation in style. But then I also think about the writer who has a substantial canon of literature, not just the one-hit wonder. And Toni Morrison hits all of those.
Right.
I would add a historical resonance. I think the themes that Toni Morrison deals with are she's writing about the absolute core of American consciousness and dealing with things that, on the one hand, we think we understand. We think we understand our heritage. We think we know about the last 200 years. But she writes about it in such a way that it both emotionally and intellectually resonates. I think for particularly, maybe I'm an exceptionalist, but I think American literature, the huge books of authors in American literature must do that. And that's what I think Philip Roth does too, although on a slightly smaller scale. Mm. Not to put him down. He's just different.
I'm talking with Tom Conley, professor of English at Suffolk University, and Sue Weaver Shop, associate dean for the Master of Liberal Arts program at the Harvard Extension School. And we're looking at what books might be still read in 2080, similar to a list that was put together in 1936 by the editors of a publication called The Colophon. So what about these universal themes that you know, are so important in bringing people to a work and having them go back to it? That was a point you made earlier.
Yes,
coming
yes.
back to something is very important.
Well, I just have to say, somewhere Norman Mailer is punching the sod, trying to get out of his grave to get on this list and somehow get into this room. He's talking about he had such grandiosity, and it's just nobody talked. He's only been dead a couple of years, but he might as well be on this list because nobody talks about him
anymore.
That's
very interesting.
Well, and also to pick up on that, but also with Callie's question as well, in looking back at that list of 1936 writers and so forth, Sinclair Lewis and Theodore Dreiser were doing something in their fiction that illuminated aspects of American culture in a very realistic way that simply had not been brought into fiction before. This was a very frank way of looking at what American life was really about and what some of its anxieties were about and what some of its dark side happened to be about. The same thing really with Ernest Hemingway. I mean, no one had really written the World War I novel the way that Hemingway did, or subsequently the World War II novel in exactly the same way. You know, so again, this rather grand set of themes and ideas that showed us something that we had not seen before in fiction. I think this is one of the chief criteria. When Eugene O'Neill was writing his plays and made it on this list, and again, this is interesting because almost nobody reads Eugene O'Neill's plays anymore or appreciates them, except for Long Day's Journey and Tonight, as Tom was saying. But at the time, no one had written plays like this. So again, that criterion of freshness and illuminating something that is deep and important and that resonates with a lot of readers, I think that's the criterion. It's interesting to me the two poets that made it on this 1936 list. Mm-hmm. Yes, we're all still reading Robert Frost, people who are readers of poetry in the first place, and that is a shrinking community all of the time. But Frost is still taught in the classroom in American literature courses. Edna St. Vincent Millay, however, has fallen out of the canon completely.
She's come back. She's back in the Norton Anthology of American Literature,
put
her back
in.
But compared to Frost, there's no comparison with Frost.
And
she was gone, completely gone for a long time.
That's right. But as far as actually spending time teaching her in the classroom and poetry courses, you're going to say, okay, she's in there, but, you know, let's move on to one of the more major female poets, if that's what we're going to do.
I always thought that Robert Frost could hang around forever because you could take him at face value or go deeper.
Yes.
And,
exactly.
You know, that gives you a generational appeal and longevity on that.
But something else to pick up on what you just said about realism. I think of Theodore Dreiser as a character in E.L. Doctorow's Ragtime. And Doctorow has a whole chapter where Dreiser is pacing around his room trying to get it right as he's looking out the window. And, of course, it's Doctorow's. This is, again, what is a sort of a highbrow problem with literature today. Doctorow's a writer writing about a writer who's writing.
Right.
Wow, that's really going to bring people onto Amazon.com.
Well, that brings me to next names. You mentioned Toni Morrison is the only name right now that would survive into 2080. Who else? Sue Weaver.
I put one poet on the list just because we had Edna St. Vincent Millay and Robert Frost on the 1936 list. That would have to be Seamus Heaney.
Oh, yes.
I think he may be the greatest living poet. He did win the Nobel Prize for Literature.
And that goes to your globalization point.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Mm-hmm. But again, what he does, very much under the influence of Frost and very much under the influence of some other 19th century writers like Wordsworth and so on, he gives us a window into the deepest levels of human experience. And he's not just writing about Ireland and Irish experience. He is writing about this kind of visceral, elemental aspect of human nature, where we really do see into the relationship that human beings have with nature and with each other and with the land. And it's very deep, and it's beautifully, beautifully crafted. So he's my poet on the list.
All right. Back to you, Tom
Well,
Conley.
I finally thought of a playwright, Edward Albee. I think that Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Three Tall Women are two plays from the middle, late 20th century that people who want to know not only what was going on in the American theater, but what was going on in the American consciousness will be interested in, because these plays deal with sexuality, history, and consciousness in a way that I think will be interesting to people 80 years from now.
All right. Back to you, Sue Weavershot.
Well, now we go into the flames for sure, because after Toni Morrison and Seamus Heaney, a little bit more on shaky ground. Again, thinking about who readers are reading now with literary merit, who will probably continue to be read into the future, I have to put J.K. Rowling on that list.
Ah, Harry Potter.
Because she has sold 450 million books, which is a lot. And I think each generation of young people coming along, they're going to pass on the Harry Potter novels. And they are well-crafted. She is a good writer. She does tell an amazing story. And I think she has longevity simply because each generation of young people coming along, they're going to tell their kids, you've got to read the Harry Potter novels.
It's already happening.
Yes.
You're absolutely right.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
I was going to say, it's also generational, because I read it as an adult because my niece and nephew, when they were young, were reading it.
Yes.
And I love them.
Mm-hmm.
Really well done. Are there any classics you see that'll make way for new voices, because you think they're going to be phased out? You talked a little bit about Edna St. Vincent Millay going, coming, whatever. Anybody considered classic now, being taught now, no more in 2080?
I wonder how much longer people will be able to deal with Mark Twain.
Really?
Because now he's already, Huckleberry Finn is about it. And I wonder how many boys and girls out there are reading Tom Sawyer in anything but an abridged version or in a, you know, graphic, you know, comic book type thing. You know, again, you know, specialists, but in terms of, you know, there's still the Mark Twain Society and the Mark Twain Award for Humor. But I wonder if, you know, we can handle his cynicism and anti-sentimental view of America. I mean, yeah, I think Huckleberry Finn will increasingly be an historic novel in the sense that we want a glimpse of the 19th century and we're going to look at this. And, you know, the problematic relationship between Jim and Huck, I think, is not something that will sustain it through, you know, the next century.
However, it is remarkable that it's still controversial.
Yes.
I mean, it still ends up on banned book lists in different states in the United States.
That's for another conversation, because that's about a nation not dealing with a fundamental issue of race.
Exactly.
All right, since we're running out of time, but I want to make sure I get some more names out here. So throw out some more.
Shall we go fast?
Yeah.
I put Stephen King on the list.
Yes, yeah,
and
I agree.
Not because he's a great writer, but because he is an abundant writer and because he knows how to tell a great story, and he's got an enormous readership that I think will pass on that recommendation to future readers. I also put Don DeLillo on the list. I think he's a very interesting writer, doing something very different, and his sort of postmodern style in a lot of his novels.
Any title in particular?
Fascinating. Well, I just finished Cosmopolis recently, and I thought it was a remarkable, remarkable book.
Libra is remarkable.
Yeah.
Cormac McCarthy is the right. When I asked my writing students, I know that's they. All were in agreement, hands down.
Really?
He's on my list, too.
Yeah,
really?
The Road.
Wow.
I will say the name Thomas Pynchon, and that's all.
Okay. All right.
I slogged through two of his, you know, V and The Crying of Lot 49. But he's the sort of person I think, and I wanted to mention this, there are writers who people talk about reading.
Yeah. Yes,
there are
exactly.
books that people carry around.
Right. Yes.
And I think Life of Pi is on that list because of the movie.
Oh,
yes.
And that's
yeah.
it. Okay,
yeah.
all right.
Well, it's what people used to say about Joyce's Ulysses, that it was the most famous novel that nobody had ever read.
Or the Cliff Notes, anyway.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, anybody, one quick one from either one, one more from either one of you?
I ventured Margaret Atwood.
Oh, yes, okay.
Because I thought, I think Margaret Atwood is a superb writer, and she has gone in many different directions with her writing. I mean, I think she's a fascinating person. I had Philip Roth on there because so many people had recommended Roth to me, and so I put Roth on. I added Salman Rushdie also because,
really?
Again, tough going, but... Yep. taking us somewhere new.
I still think John Cheever's stories will be read by anybody who wants to know about suburban life in the 50s and 60s.
All right.
Good point.
That's our list from Tom Connolly and Sue Weaver's shop for 2080. We've been talking about today's literature and popular fiction with a look at what books might endure and what writers will still be relevant in the future. And I've been speaking with Thomas Connolly, a professor of English at Suffolk University, and Sue Weaver's shop, associate dean for the Master of Liberal Arts program at the Harvard Extension School. Thank you both.
Thank you, Callie.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. The conversation never ends online at WGBHnews.org. Boston Public Radio is a production of WGBH Radio. I'm Callie Crossley. Have a great afternoon.